morning, hearing House Bill 5035, continuing the public employees retirement system. Dallas, do you have anything to say to us this morning?
Well, just that we'll be working on this document prepared by the retirement system, the budget summary. This is a period where he'll be reviewing in detail the budget request, the various components.
Cedric, if you preside and have him come forward, I'll just plan to the committee and be right back.
Very good. If you'll come forward, please, and continue your presentation for the vast audience that's watching on web TV and on the video cameras. Riveted to the screens all around them all.
Thank you, Representative Hayden. I hope our ratings are good. Better than the XFL. If I might, Representative Hayden, if I could open with a couple comments about questions that were raised earlier to make sure that we're being responsive. We handed out, gave to Mr. Wyand, a memo that addresses most, if not all, and I'm looking to staff to see if we hit all of the questions that were raised. We hit most of the questions that were raised yesterday. In addition, and if Representative Butler, whose question seemed to be most on point with this topic, would like to do this if he is not able to get here today. Oh, he is. That's perfect. So as I was saying, we have passed out a memo that tries to respond to most of the questions that we can quickly get answers to overnight, to the questions that were raised yesterday. Yesterday there were also a number of questions raised about service levels as well as the deferred compensation program, and we were able to do some quick research on this topic. And if you could give that to Mr. Wyand. What I'm passing out, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, but for anybody who would like to, or if the committee would like to, we certainly can. We were able to survey a number of agencies very quickly, some of our peer agencies, about what their service levels goals were, the types of activities they conducted, and how successful they were in actually achieving them. And you can see that OPERS is on the left, the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System, and we were able to get answers from Kansas, Illinois, Idaho, and Texas. Washington and a number of other states are still responding to us. We hope they'll get back to us. But the two points that I'd make here is that the service level, the types of services we provide and the service levels, as I said, are within that band of industry practice by our peers in other states. And while the emphasis may differ, for example, there's a number here, a number of sister agencies here, peer agencies, that do not provide a centralized telephone call center, that instead field calls as they come in just anywhere in the agency. We happen to do it in a centralized manner because we think it's far more efficient. But many of them provide individual counseling, some with no waiting time whatsoever. We have about an 18-week wait if you want to have an individual session. A number of them provide group counseling. Many of them provide website and email responses, very similar to what we do. Written communications, again, we're within the band. Texas, for example, seems to send a member handbook to everybody under the sun. We're kind of in the middle there. So I guess the point that I would make is that we can continue to do some of this work, but the message that I want to leave with you is that the data seems to say that our service levels are pretty much in the band. We might have a different mix, but in the band of those provided by other states. The bottom line is the one that I think that might be interesting, particularly to Representative Butler, and that is the issue of the deferred compensation plan. We've done some quick research on this and consulted with DOJ, and concluded that the statute, in fact, instructs us, and when I say us, I mean the PERS board, to establish such a program. That it is statutorily mandated. The form of the program, other than it be a trust, similar to the PERS trust, is set forth. But apart from that, the agency apparently and the board has a substantial amount of discretion as to how to put the program together. And as you can see in the bottom line, having a deferred compensation program alongside the traditional retirement program is not unusual in other states as well. So I just wanted to provide some context to the questions that were raised yesterday. If there are any questions on that, I'd be happy to field them now or later. I know this is a lot of small print data to throw at you in a short period of time.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you. The deferred comp is statutorily mandated, but we don't have to operate it as a state. It could be just subbed out. Is that correct, then?
As I look at the statute, we have to have a trust. The PERS board must be the trustees, but whether or not it's contracted out as we do to a third party to largely operate, and we as we do to City Street, that appears to be at the board's discretion.
Okay, so it could be contracted out.
Yeah, and in fact is, in large part.
And the level of service, do we know the level of service under the deferred comp plan, section 457? Do we don't know of any? Well, let's see that. All we have there is just the number of participants, percentage of participants at 42% versus 50% in Iowa. Is that what, or Illinois, rather?
No, that is correct. We're still gathering data on to the extent of their service provision to this program and how well or not it's integrated with their service to members in the traditional pension program. We weren't able overnight to get that level of detail back to you.
Notice that Texas has video presentations of their programs. Have you ever thought, perhaps, of using that in lieu of the counseling sessions?
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, we do use videotapes in addition to, but we haven't, you could say in some sense, substitution for additional group counseling sessions. And I think we're also working on providing them to employers. Is that not correct? We have, I think one of the comments that I would like to make as well in response to your earlier questions is that I mentioned that we were pushing very hard to get people into group sessions rather than individual sessions. You can see that in a group session, you can pretty much sign up for a PERS group session and get into it within a month. But if you want to have an individual session, we have withdrawn resources from that sufficient to the point where you have to wait 18 weeks to get into an individual session.
Video conferencing via possibility there?
The opportunity for offering videos directly to individuals is a real possibility. The issue is always, does it spur more questions than it answers? And sometimes by putting a human being in front of folks, you can both present the information and address all the questions so that you don't have round two.
My final question, does your website have frequently asked questions on it?
Yes, it does. It has quite a bit of information both about recent board actions, and we also have our phone system has recordings on frequently asked questions, for example, where a lot of people might call in about what the board's crediting decision is in March, which is a very regular, it's a item piece of information that we don't need a human being to continually redeliver. So we'll have a recording and say, if you're interested in that number, press this button and you'll get
a lot of hits on your website.
We do have a lot of hits on the website. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
How about a hybrid so that you would send out the tapes and put some responsibility on the folks that are coming then to the group counseling so they would have seen the tape. The expectation is they do their homework, watch the tape, and then they come to the group counseling quickly after the time the tape arrived.
Chair Clowner, Representative Johnson, that sounds like an excellent question, and I don't know the answer to whether or not we do that, but those are the kinds of things we like to experiment with.
A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes,
I apologize for not being able to quickly pull it out of the voluminous information, but have you calculated what a cutback in your counseling services would actually amount to monetarily? Because it seems to me that if it takes 18 weeks right now to get an individual appointment, you're de facto no longer offering individual appointments. And why, instead of just torturing it to death, why not just stop?
The first question, Chair Clarno, Representative Johnson, I don't think we've done a analysis on the margin, but individual counseling, as my colleague from BAM points out, we have about $1 million of our budget associated with those types of activities and their support. And the 18 weeks is really a result of two things. One is how many resources we're willing to devote to it. And as I say, we've devoted more resources to group because we think it's more efficient, more productive. But we haven't terminated it. Maybe we are giving it death by a thousand cuts. But it's also the 18 weeks is partly a result of demand for it. People like it. We find, by the way, that when people come in at age 55, 60, 65, it's a sensitive time for them, and they like the notion that they may not have ever sat down with anybody, particularly a stranger, to talk about, you know, the last 30 years of their life and their finances. So it's we find that it's a pretty sensitive time.
I don't mean to sound insensitive to their sensitivity, but I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that you just said it's what they'd like. I'd actually like it if you'd come to my house and talk to me about it. I mean, so it's sort of a scale of what's achievable. And if there's $1 million being spent in a program that now asks somebody to wait 18 weeks for individual counseling, that doesn't strike me as particularly responsive. And to save $1 million, maybe there's an alternative that is not quite the Cadillac, but it's a perfectly serviceable vehicle to get the information in an appropriate and accurate way to the retirees. It just seems to me that 18 weeks, I'd be less miffed if I was asked to watch a tape and come to a timely group session than if I called up and said, I'm 18 weeks out.
Chair Carano, Representative Johnson, the only practical comment I would make in this respect is that in the end, unless we decide not to answer members' questions, we have to look at the issue in the following sense, that these things are tied together. So, for example, if we cut back on written information, we may get more phone calls. If we cut back on individual counseling to a certain subset of our members who are uncomfortable in group sessions, who may not be able or willing to ask those questions at that time, we may end up with more phone traffic. So we constantly experiment with doing more of one and less of another, and sometimes the experiments actually backfire on us. When we do less of something, it turns out we generate 3 times more demand for service somewhere else.
Madam Chair, I'm compelled to follow up on this. Make no mistake, I am not advocating not answering members' questions. And you seem to imply that I was.
I want to be perfectly clear. I apologize. It was more the connection between the two. That it was a statement of what our general practice is, and that sometimes if we do less of one, we actually generate more in another venue. I apologize if that perception was taken.
I want to answer members' questions, but I'm just trying to figure out, for a system that seems sort of inherently flawed, that costs $1 million, there's got to be a better way to timely and accurately respond to members' questions that isn't 18 weeks. Representative Hayden?
Well, to continue that line of thought, to having recently gone through this myself, I found personally that there were so many choices available that it was almost overwhelming. And rather than go through counseling of any kind, I just sort of took a dart. And I was happy with myself. So I like picking stocks.
So Trixie ended up with his retirement.
But in defense of the system, even though there's a waiting time to get into the counseling, if you would like it, you do start the program about 5 years out. About 5 years out, you start waving flags and saying, if you're going to retire in the next 5 years, start thinking about it. So there is time to get into the system.
Representative Hayden, that is a good point, and we're going to do more of that once we get our technology platform in place so that we can see possible decision points coming from our members, intervene early, for example, as Representative Johnson and others have suggested, with early information and escalating information so that the net amount of service that we give, or cumulative amount of service we give to any member as they approach these complicated decisions that they have to make, is the smallest we can. And we have many opportunities. We have print. We have the web page. The question is, what's the most cost-efficient mix of those to get the member to the point where we hope they don't have to throw a dart?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Please continue.
With respect to the budget as a whole, quite frankly, Sarah Gates from BAM did such an excellent job presenting the key elements of our budget. I really don't see the need from our perspective, that's not to say it's from the committee's perspective, to go over the same packages again. We have tried to be highly specific in what our requests are, highly specific in what the amounts are for, and what purpose they would serve. Sarah did such an outstanding job of summarizing them yesterday. I would only mention that a few things in retrospect are worth discussing. One of them was that there's a package of about $1 million that seems to be miscellaneous items. There's a $327,000 item in there, which is not an expenditure on our part for administration at all. It's a pass-through.
Is that in this document?
That is on page 15 of the document, section 102.
That's the document that says public employees retirement.
109.3. Perhaps we can, should we use your document, sir? Do you have it broken down?
Madam Chair, for the record, Sarah Gates, Budget Management. In my packet, it's a little more explicit in what the various components are. If you can refer to page 8 of that, it shows.
That's this packet.
Yeah, the one that's just recommended.
And the only clarifying point I wanted to make about that is that this is really reflecting a change in budget accounting in which insurance premiums are passing through the agency but right back out. This is not a new expenditure on our part, but we still need legislative authority to, in essence, receive the money and then pass it back on through. But there's no new FTE, there's no new program activity. And I know that that $1 million kind of stands out as kind of outsized in terms of the option packages. And I just wanted to clarify that point. I don't know if Sarah had any other clarification she wanted to add.
That's package 102.
That's correct, Madam Chair. He's referring to the $367,000 of professional services, and Budget Management is comfortable with that amount. It is truly a pass-through, and they need it, but it happens to be a limited account rather than a non-limited account.
And then I think I brought up one of the things. Let me just go over to be sure that I understand. In your budget document in the summary, it shows $609,756 in attorney fees, and this $276,600 of attorney fees in this package is it like a shortfall, but it does it add into the $609,000?
Madam Chair, no, it does not add. It's a component of the $639,000. The reason the agency is asking for this is in the approved budget, they only have $282,000 of limitations for 9901. Their estimated expenditure is $523,000. And they, based on the increased volume of appeals and lawsuits, they simply need more attorney general limitation, and that is why they're requesting for it in this package.
I've gotten real interested in community dispute resolution and how our agencies utilize that. I noticed on this piece of paper that you handed out, you have the appeals and contested case hearings, et cetera. I see you have a assessment or a pay for a community dispute resolution, not community, but dispute resolution services. How often and how early? Can you explain to me how you use that?
I'm going to ask Chair Clarno if Mr. Delaney can come up and describe the process. I believe that on that same piece of paper, you'll see a column of what is, in essence, early intervention, which is requests canceled, I believe is the column. And that really reflects the fact that the member has an opportunity to come in. We work with the member. They may bring in additional information in an informal setting. And so those get dropped out of the process with relatively little expenditure. So we are, in essence, doing some of that very same thing to try not to, to see what we can weed out before it moves into a more formal and therefore more expensive process.
So would you introduce yourself?
Yes. For the record, my name is Steve Delaney, Manager of Government Relations at PERS. Chair Clarno, PERS is in the informal, does use ADR in an informal basis at this point. We always invite the members to come in and talk to us at any point during the process. We are preparing to formalize that in administrative rules. We just have begun conversations with the Department of Justice in the last 2 months talking about how ADR, alternative dispute resolution, would fit into the PERS system, because we do have, for the non-disability side, these hearings on the right side of the column, are statutory benefits, and there's question there as to how much dispute resolution can actually involve when it comes to benefits. But on the disability side, where it's looking at medical records and trying to determine whether or not they support a member's claim, there is much more room for that resolution process, and we are preparing to put that into a formal ruled process.
Well, I think, I'd be looking at that process a lot if you can and if you need statutory help to get there. I think that one of the things as we look at these various budgets and sitting on more than one budget committee, you begin to realize the attorney costs. And we certainly are not saying that you don't need attorney costs. There are times that we have litigation that we must have the attorney costs, but the alternative dispute resolution program is an excellent way to relieve some of the attorney costs that we have, and I hope that we'll utilize it more.
Chair Carno, could I make one more
sure.
comment about that? The PERS board has, in my year experience with them, has been extraordinarily open in their willingness to hear stakeholders' complaints. And our process is really built around the notion that, one, they have the expectation that they'll be able to proceed through the staff and directly to the board. We're looking at the entire process with the board to decide whether or not that's the best process. But right now, the expectation among the members is that, one, the board has demonstrated their willingness to hear those complaints after they pass through the staff. And so, one may interpret that as an invitation to go further in the process. The second thing is that because we run a trust and we are, in essence, the ultimate deep pocket, we have been extremely cautious in making sure that DOJ is involved early, hence our legal expenses, because what's at stake for us is so big that we feel it's prudent to use lawyers early rather than later. We may be making an incorrect judgment, but that's the judgment we've made so far, and it's one that has led us to a budget increase.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to get that percentage increase. When we're talking about 609,000 total AG's fees, and we're asking for an additional 276, which is included in the 609. So if we had the 609 previously, with 276 added, that we started with 333,000. Would that be approximately right?
Madam Chair, the agency got 282,398
in the 9901 budget. Okay. And we're asking for nearly 100% more at 276,000.
That is correct.
So this nearly 100% increase in the AG's fees represents the number of, for instance, if I look at the appeals and contested hearings, contested case hearings, I see the number of denials, 124, 124, 138, 128, and then this hearings request, 19, 18, then the 35 and 24. Is that where we're spending it? The 35 and 24 there, is that because of a number of hearings requests, and that's what you're indicating, Director Voigtfeld, that you're getting your staff, legal staff.
Chair Connor, Representative Butler, that is partly where we're spending it, but the two points that I'd make on this topic are, one is, this is our current run rate. I mean, this is, and it's not just contested, that's the first point. We are actually expending we're doing these activities. And so the budget limitation increase that we're asking for is not anticipatory. It kind of reflects what the current state of affairs is and has been for the last year or year and a half. The second thing is that the most expensive part is really not the contested case hearings, because we can substitute less expensive staff for much of the work that the attorneys do in the early parts of the process. Our biggest expense, probably, and we haven't broken this out, but this is my suspicion, is really involved in the major litigation that's going forward, because there we're engaging the most senior attorneys at DOJ, and in addition to our advisory attorneys there, we're actually engaging the litigation division to litigate the case on behalf of the system and the state. So I think that if we were to break out those numbers, you'd find that the litigation itself is really the most expensive, and it's the item that we have the least control over.
And the major litigation, which is it on the sheet, disability, non-disability, hearings held, appeals, second appeals, hearing request, hearings held. Where is the major litigation?
Chair Klano, Representative Butler, it's actually not on this page. I think we delivered a memo or earlier that described some of the major pieces of litigation that are ongoing. We have a consortium of member organizations, labor unions, as well as employers from around the state that are engaged in pretty fundamental litigation with the system in terms of the interpretation of the statutes over these many years. And it would take more time than we have today to go through the laundry list of significant issues that they're working on that are at issue in this litigation. But I think that if we had the opportunity to break that out, you'd see that that's a large piece of this. The appeals and contested case hearings are one of the things that's escalating most rapidly, but they're not they're not the only driver, and maybe not even from a per unit of lawyer use, the most expensive driver of this budget line.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the letter from 2 days ago relative to item B. Representative Johnson and Chair Klano asked question, list the PER litigation-related costs. And then it says note, we didn't have time to compile an ongoing PERS litigation. Attorney General's office has been contacting that information to forward committee upon receipt. Did that come in after yesterday then?
Has DOJ gotten back to us yet on a summary of the litigation?
Senator Klano, Representative Butler, for the record, I'm Dale Orr, Fiscal Services Division Administrator. In answer to your question, we have not provided that information yet. We're still working with the Department of Justice to break out the actual costs related to the litigation and also to the appeals as well. That was another piece that was requested, and we're still working on that.
Okay, thank you. I misunderstood you to believe that it's already been delivered. And
sir, I may have misled you as to the comprehensiveness of our response to date.
And I just had written a note to myself. None of that is available in-house. You don't track any of the what your legal fees are for on a regular basis, or break that down.
We haven't on an ongoing basis by case, and sometimes that's difficult because a senior attorney may be advising us on several different cases. In fact, we have several different pieces of ongoing litigation that I think there are at least two litigative attorneys working on those cases at DOJ. We could provide some measure of separation if you're interested.
I think when we see the receive the information that you have relating, because it talks about PER litigation related costs of the types of litigation that are ongoing. So
I might also say, Representative Butler, that there's a hidden cost here in that the discovery requests that we've gotten in these in the various litigations have been enormous, and I mean enormous, as those of you who have been involved in litigation know it can be. We do everything we can, per your earlier comments, to try to charge those people for the expense of copying and searching records and so on. But because we have a relatively small staff, we can charge them, but it still takes staff away from their operating duties, and they still have to then go back and do their regular operating duties, even if we do charge them. And that means that we have to, that's one of the reasons that we have overtime. I'm not saying it's the most important reason, but if we were to have the staff in here today and they were to list their grievances about what their director asked them to do, the discovery request would probably be on that list.
Representative Johnson,
how does the overtime pay, which I understand particularly in the context of the discovery request, how does that differ from standby duty pay?
I'm going to ask Mr. Orr to explain the notion of standby duty pay, which is something new to us because of some changes that we've made in the operation of our IT unit. Representative Johnson.
Chair Klano, Representative Johnson, in answer to your question, standby duty pay is a differential that we pay to mostly to our information technology staff So they are essentially on call in case we have a problem with overnight processing, because we're essentially a 24/7 operation now, where we are operating 24 hours a day, keeping not only our land systems up, our local area network system up, but also our mainframe data processing. And we start processing, say, with all the data that we have input into the system, approximately about 6 o'clock at night. We start processing, and it takes anywhere from 10 to 14 hours to complete an overnight processing. And so we need to have staff on call that if something were to go wrong, then they can be notified, they come into the office, or they can remotely access that, make whatever fix is necessary on that program if it happens to stop running, and then be able to complete the processing that's necessary.
And if I could add, Representative Johnson, it's not just that we need to process overnight, it's that while those batch processing is going on, we can't access the mainframe to do regular transactions at the staff level. It, in essence, you know, hogs our software until the batch is processed. So if it fails to process overnight, it can adversely affect the next day's regular operations. Second thing I say is that we have about 28% of our people on flex schedules, which is a state policy, and we've tried to be judicious about when we grant it so that it doesn't impact operations. But it also means that we have people that the normal workday can stretch as much as 10 hours because we have 4-10s in the state work week. And those people require the system to be up and running in order to do their job. The third thing I'd mention is that this notion of standby pay I don't think is unique to PERS. I think it's a statewide, agency-wide notion that if you have to have 24/7 operations, this is the policy you should follow.
Okay. I understand the concept. In a lot of the budgets that we have looked at up to this point, I can't remember any other agency looking at this level of standby duty pay, and they have some 24/7 requirements. It also is an area, I think, that has been subject to some considerable misinterpretation as to what constitutes standby, and certainly you can't deviate from the contract, but it's an area, at least in my experience, that there are some vagaries that result in some exceedingly high costs. My curiosity is 28% on flex schedule for a shop that is as demanding as yours appropriate personnel management? That's more than a quarter of your people.
Chair Clarno, Representative Johnson, all I can say is that we look at each case individually. We've been, I think, judicious about granting changes. The contract says that, and I just happened to review this yesterday because bargaining is ongoing, that if an employee requests a work schedule that is allowed under contract, unless we affirmatively demonstrate that it is not workable given current operations, that we're supposed to grant it. We're not permitted to be arbitrary. In fact, the current bargaining, one of the issues on the table is expanding the array of flex schedules that are available to employees. There's pluses and minuses to this. One of the pluses is that it helps us recruit. It helps us recruit single mothers who may have extraordinary skills that require a specific work schedule, for example. On the other hand, as you point out, it can cause problems, particularly when people need to work in teams and be present together. All I can say is that each of our managers is tasked with trying to make sure their section produces what they need to produce and still adhere to the contract. It's not easy, I'll grant you that.
One last question.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
It strikes me, given the totality of your budget and the magnitude of the information technology request that you have in here, that this much money for standby duty pay ought to some way be figured in to your new information technology request. It seems to me that what you're telling us without telling us is that you've got folks babysitting an old computer system. for fear that it would fail during that period of time at night when it's processing and thereby have a ripple effect through the rest of your system. But you're looking for multiple millions of dollars for a new system. Do you anticipate that the standby duty pay will disappear?
Chair Klarner, Representative Johnson, I cannot promise that it will disappear, but there's some truth to the comment that it is particularly important today, given the limitations of our system, that we go to 24/7. And it may be that you're seeing it broken out in our document because this is a relatively new budget line. When's, is this the first time that we've actually broken it out as a specific budget item?
Senator Klarno, Representative Johnson, we did have it broken out as a separate line item before, but as our processing times increased, so too did our need to maintain, to go to the 24/7. That has occurred over about the last 4 years, and so therefore our expenditures have increased in that particular area.
Chair Klarno, one last.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
You'd have no reason to know this, but I used to run a division of a state agency, and we were charged with a 24/7 task of doing search and rescue for downed airmen. As I began tracking how often that service was called upon versus the amount of money for the standby time, it became abundantly obvious there was a smarter, better way to do it, and we farmed out the program, and the standby time disappeared. My question to you is, have you looked at any other processing mechanisms, or have you analyzed how often your folks that are on standby are actually called in to deal with a problem? Is it a frequent occurrence or rare?
Chair Klarner, Representative Johnson, I don't have statistics to offer you on this question. Part of the way to look at this is to say how often you use it. The other way to look at it is like an insurance premium. What's the consequences if it happens? Are the costs so big that it's that you pay it anyway and you hope that you never actually have to use it? We'd have to look at the analysis of it and give you a response that looks at it through both lenses. With respect to farming out this, right now, because of the limitations of our software portfolio and our inability to really change it very easily, and our current arrangement with the DAS data center and the link, and it's our judgment that changing that whole arrangement prior to the establishment of a new program doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Because what we'd like to do and what we've proposed in the new platform is to relook at the data link itself, the provision of data services, and perhaps per your suggestion, one of the opportunities is to farm it out, and with it, a 24/7 responsibility. I believe, and the staff will correct me if I'm wrong, that in the deferred compensation program, the 24/7 responsibility for keeping systems up is the third-party administrators, City Streets. So we're not in the 24/7 business when it comes to the provision of data center and record keeping in the deferred compensation program. It runs along the lines of your suggestion. Whether or not the right way to do that for Opus, we're discussing that with DAS IRMD right now. And we've already had them up and had a good session about what, if we're able to build, if we're permitted to build Opus, what might be the data center services that this needs, how are they positioned to satisfy them, and also from our point of view, we're interested, as I mentioned the first day, to having some provision services agreement or contract in place, whether it's with DAS or somebody else if DAS feels it doesn't want the business.
Is it a legal requirement or a customer service issue that if you went down overnight and you weren't able to process forms, I know it would have a ripple effect into your next day's business, but is it a legal mandate or a customer service requirement?
Chair Klarner, Representative Johnson, excellent question. It can be both. It for sure is a customer service issue because if we have to rebatch the next day and it limits our staff's access to the system, their ability to answer questions is going to be affected adversely. But the other thing is that there are in statute, and I mentioned this earlier, some customer service requirements that relate to our mandated completion of transactions and the issuance of a check in specific periods of time. So that if the system were to go down overnight and we would have to, in essence, rebatch the next day, for instance. It could affect those. I'm not saying that it would in every case. Every day, every problem is different, as you know. But it could affect a statutory mandate. We do, in some instances, run right up to the edge in terms of making statutory requirements and getting a checkout.
Okay. Would that DMV were as customer responsive? Any other questions?
I have a couple myself. And these, the information I got here is from the summary page that I mentioned earlier on the Attorney General costs. When I see overtime payments of $278,000, flexible benefits $2,594,000, per diem unclassed $17,900,000, all other differentials $184,000, I don't understand those various categories, what they stand for, and why the sums are in the per diem unclassed $17 million. Can you explain that a little bit to me?
If I may step in and help here. The first one I think you're referring to is it's titled Classified Unclassified Salary and Per Diem. $17 million, is that correct?
Yes.
That is your basic salary that is paid to the employees at the Public Employees Retirement System. That is where in the ABIS system, mm-hmm. all of, like, your salary would go, my salary would go.
Okay.
That is why you're seeing such a large number there.
Okay.
The flexible benefit line that you referred to is where your part of your insurance go. This is the costs that are associated with the insurance and any flex benefits that you're going to put that term related to the Public Employee Benefit Board. That is where those are budgeted.
And that's because this system categorizes it that way, because it is very very confusing for flex, like talking about insurance payments, when in fact, like the director testified to earlier, that 28% of staff is on flex policy is sure confusing.
Yes,
okay.
They have nothing to do with each
okay.
other. Those are totally, basically, the agency has no control over these line items. These mm-hmm. are based on the amount of salary, the type of position, whatever has been bargained.
Okay.
You had a couple of other questions. I believe one, what were the other line items?
The other line items, let's see. Well, the overtime payments, I put at $278,000. Was any of that to do with the Y2K, do you know, payments?
I don't have an answer to that. I do know that the $278,000 that's being requested includes the $152,000 that is in this package, and that is because the agency has been under budgeted. They've not had enough limitation, and they've had to borrow from other line items in the past, and they're trying to make their budget more in line with actual expenditures. Dale, did you have any
questions
related overtime?
Senator Clarno, Chair Clarno,
mm-hmm.
We did have some overtime at December 31st, 1999, that was in our budget, but that's not the majority of what our overtime costs are. It's related to ongoing operational needs.
Well, it had been brought to my attention just recently, or I would have asked all agency this as to how much their expenditures they thought they were paid out in overtime or some sort of benefits for Y2K problems. So if you could get that to me, I'd appreciate it. Some dissension evidently among managers and others as to whether this money was adequately, not in your agency specifically, but this has been brought to my attention. So I'd appreciate to have that. Yes.
I'd like to put a slightly finer point on your question.
Okay.
Would you include in the overtime any bonuses that were paid?
Bonus. Senator Clarno, Representative Johnson, we did check recently. I think you're referring to the information technology bonuses for retention regarding the year 2000.
That's what we're talking about.
We did not pay any out from HERS.
And
for another clarification on the point earlier, we'll develop for Chair Clarno a list of our Y2K costs. However, we treated that as a separate budgeted item, and I think that was part of a phase out.
Okay.
that we had. We had some specific dollars that were in the previous budget, and we phased most of those dollars out, and we will...
Well, evidently, a lot of agencies have had to give major, big bonuses to keep people around. Obviously, where you have your 24-hour policy, you probably had people either on that already and then on an overtime basis or are compensated for it that way. But this is something we'll be asking from now on.
Well, Chair Clarno, I hope they stay because they like working with us. But let me say, from the perspective of a general manager and not the budget line per se, that my initiation with this agency tells me that we rely on overtime more than we probably should in the long run. But we have no choice. The reason for that is that most of what we do is extremely unique to PERS. It's nobody else does exactly what we do for the most part. And we've kept, I think, a reasonably tight staff, which means that we have a lot of instances where there's only one person that knows how to do, for example, tax code compliance, a single person. And so if a tax issue comes up, the only option we have in the shorter intermediate run is to require overtime. And so that's why I think it's part of the reason why you see overtime high. It's in lieu of having two people being able to do the same thing. I don't think that's a really good way to run it in the long run. And one of the things that, again, I hate to hark back to our new technology platform, but one of the major things we're trying to build into it is something called the knowledge repository or knowledge management, where we are writing down all of our practices and capabilities and putting them literally at the touch of a button so that we don't have to rely on what is between the ears of a single person and therefore, you know, be condemned to using overtime to solve problems, like, for example, the Young case. When we have 2,000 transactions that we need to redo, there will inevitably be overtime, even if we bring in some temporary people to help us.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Again, a finer point. It scares me a little bit when you say condemned overtime because one person is the repository of a certain body of knowledge. What happens, God forbid, if that person gets hit by a bus? I mean, then you don't have the option of overtime, and it seems to me that you are making yourself exceedingly vulnerable.
Chair Clarno, Representative Johnson, you have just echoed a conversation that we have at the senior management level all the time. The problem is that we don't want to be coming before this committee asking for two of everything either. So, again, we're in a dilemma in that we don't want to come and ask for two tax compliance people and so on and so forth. So we're doing two things. One is we're re-altering how we spend our training money to cross-training. I mean, that's the highest priority right now is cross-training. And the second thing is we're building this knowledge management, knowledge repository, so that more than one person can access what is between the ears of too many single people in the agency. So we share your concern. We've got two initiatives underway to try to resolve it. But I agree with you. It's not the way we'd like to be in the long run, but we also don't want to be coming down here and asking for two of everything.
We're going to take a five-minute break, and when we come back, I have some more questions. I'll just share with you what they are, so if you need to get some responses that you don't have off the top of your head. I kind of want to talk about out-of-state travel, where you go and why, in-state travel, which is kind of high, $137,000, and let me know what the necessity for that is. And I don't see anything on that budget summary about Secretary of State's audits, so if you'd share with me that situation and share with me the increase of FTEs from 37 FTE increase since the 99 budget, I'd appreciate it. And we'll take a five-minute break, come back.